Ladies and gentlemen, It's All Politics brings you an exclusive eavesdropping report on the lunchtime conversation between President Obama and erstwhile presidential rival Mitt Romney at the White House. Let's join them in progress. Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon. And how about that lunch, Ron? I understand that Mitt Romney only paid 53% of the check.
I understand that, too. No, I think actually he should be paying 47% of the check because that's how much of the vote he winds up getting.
Well, that's true. But see, Obama was the 47%. The reason I said the 53% is because then the listener would get the fact that the remainder was
53 minus 100.
No, 100 minus 53.
Would be 47.
And that would be the famous 47% that brought down the Mitt Romney candidacy.
And now we have the irony that people, some people, are bringing up that as the national popular vote for president is counted and eventually certified, it appears that Mitt Romney will have received approximately 47% of the vote plus a fraction, rounding down to 47%, which would be ironic, would it not?
It would absolutely. Just like if Herman Cain had run for president and got 99.9% of the vote, that would have been ironic, too.
Or 9.99% of the
vote. Or 999. And if one of those bottles happened to fall?
As the seven. And at this point, the listener is doubtless asking, I was told there would be no math.
Or interest.
And by the way, I don't believe there was any beer taken down from the wall at that luncheon at the White House.
Why is that?
It would be because Barack Obama doesn't drink during the day, and Mitt Romney doesn't drink during this century.
Although he does drink milk.
Have you been drinking? You smell like a dairy.
What do you say you share a drink with your old man, huh?
Father, I'm only 38. Now come inside.
In a moment, Matt, in a moment.
Of course, that was an actor portraying one of the Romney sons on Saturday Night Live. Okay, one thing that was probably on the lunch menu would be a serving up of rice, Susan Rice.
Well, I don't think that Republican senators are that hungry. And what's interesting, we've known for a while that Lindsey Graham and John McCain and Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire clearly seemed to be opposed to the prospective nomination. It was very interesting. Susan Rice was coming up to Capitol Hill, well, ostensibly to talk about Benghazi and her role as the U.N. ambassador during the crisis and the violence on September 11th. But ultimately, this is about a prospective, which I've never seen before, a prospective nomination for Secretary of State once Hillary Clinton leaves the job.
Which, of course, she has not even done yet.
No.
And there have been hints that she might stick around a little while, perhaps to defuse this particular situation. Go ahead.
But usually when a president names, for example, a Supreme Court nominee, they make the condolence calls, but the obligatory calls on Capitol Hill, talking to members of the Judiciary Committee, things like that. But this is, first of all, one, there's no nomination yet. But two, it seems like it's just trying to understand what the opposition is. And we understand that Lindsey Graham and Kelly Ayotte, certainly they would oppose her. But I thought more instructive was what Susan Collins said on Wednesday of this week. She votes with Democrats probably more often and probably will vote with Democrats more often than any other Republican in the next Senate or the next Congress. And yet Susan Collins seemed to have clear reservations about Susan Rice.
I would need to have additional information before I could support her nomination. She's not been posted yet. Our Homeland Security Committee investigation is ongoing. There are many different players in this, and there's much yet to be learned. So I think it would be premature for me to reach that judgment now.
All right, this had to be very bad news for the White House to hear, as you say, the most moderate Republican probably in the entire chamber come out and say, look, I'm on board with the others who are really saying that this is a big deal, this Benghazi thing. We feel like she went out and did political talking points. As the UN ambassador, that was not her proper role. The White House should have put somebody else out if they just wanted a political person. And that she can't now hide behind the skirts of the CIA and say, oh, I just repeated the public talking points, when she also knew more than she was letting on those talk shows.
Right, and we've also
on a classified basis.
Right, and we've also heard a lot about the skirts of the CIA, but that's another story completely.
Oh, you picked up on that little reference, didn't
you? Yes, as did the listener, I'm sure. But, you know, the question, of course, is whether the president wants to have this confirmation fight over Susan Rice. I mean, certainly he won the election. He should pick his own Secretary of State. But does he want to have a battle in the Senate? Now, he doesn't want to shirk away from the battle, as a lot of Democrats accused him of doing during the first term. But at the same time, do you want a tarnished and perhaps question mark hanging over somebody as important as the next Secretary of State?
It's a true conundrum. It is really an interesting political puzzle. Among other things, the president knows that he owes his reelection to the women's vote, which he carried and which was slightly larger than the male vote. He also knows that he owes his reelection to another outstanding turnout and overwhelming majority among African Americans. So does he want to turn around the next month and deny this plum, this highly symbolic job in the United States government to a African-American woman? That would look bad in his case, and I don't think the Republicans really want him to nominate her and have a fight in which they resist her either for largely the same reasons.
Well, if you buy the argument that it's about race,
about race in that sense. You cannot escape the fact that she's a woman and that she's African-American. You can't escape that, and symbolically, whether it has anything to do with the actual objections being raised by the Republicans or not, the identity remains.
Well, then I can make the case that if you vote against Clarence Thomas for Supreme Court, that's because you're voting against a black man.
It could be made, and it was made at the time.
And I didn't buy that argument then either.
Well, I'm just saying, when you make an appointment, let's put it this way. When George H.W. appointed Clarence Thomas, did it matter to him that Clarence Thomas was an African-American?
Absolutely.
All right. And it matters to Barack Obama that Susan Rice is. At the same time, it works both ways. Neither side really wants the fight to be over that particular set of issues, but there they are because she has that identity.
And when Susan Collins was talking about the arguments against Susan Rice, she also talked about the pluses for nominating John Kerry for Secretary of State.
I think John Kerry would be an excellent appointment and would be easily confirmed by his colleagues.
There's truth to that, because you know that whenever a former member of the Senate is nominated for a cabinet post like John Tower.
All right. Okay. A lot of people thought that the 1989 John Tower nomination for Secretary of Defense really started the era of bad feeling, or at least worsened it greatly and contributed to the partisanship that's been so rife the last couple of decades in Washington. And I think there's some truth in that. I mean, the John Tower thing was very nasty. And clearly, in this case, Susan Rice is not going to be that kind of story. It's going to be a somewhat different kind of story. And John Kerry would be a, 90-0 kind of confirmation fight. And also, there would be the prospect that Scott Brown could come back to the Senate, because if John Kerry were to suddenly join the cabinet, either as Secretary of State or Defense, well, then they'd have to have a special election within something like 160 days maximum. And so he could be back very quickly. He could be back by the summer. He could be certainly back by the next time we have a Supreme Court fight.
The other longtime incumbent senator we're talking about on Capitol Hill is Senator Grover Norquist.
Oh, yes. Who has been reelected and reelected. When was he first elected?
Of course, Grover Norquist is not a member of the Senate, but there are a lot of people who pay respect, shall we say, to Grover Norquist going back decades. But there seems to be some weakening of that among Republicans regarding the no-tax pledge that many Republicans have taken for decades in honor of Grover Norquist and his anti-tax coalition.
And it's a story that so many people are suddenly coming out and saying they no longer feel obligated or no longer feel bound by this pledge. But how many people is it really?
Well, I'm not obligated on the pledge. I made Tennesseans aware. I was just elected that the only thing I'm honoring is the oath that I take when I'm sworn in this January.
The pledge you signed 20 years ago, 18 years ago, is for that Congress. For instance, if I were in Congress in 1941, I would have signed a supported declaration of war against Japan. I'm not going to attack Japan today. The world has changed.
I agree with Grover we shouldn't raise rates, but I think Grover is wrong when it comes to we can't cap deductions and buy down debt. What do you do with the money? I want to buy down debt and cut rates to create jobs, but I will violate the pledge, long story short.
Times have changed significantly, and I care more about this country than I do about a 20-year-old pledge.
Those, of course, were the voices of Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, Representative Peter King from New York, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and Senator Saxby Chambliss of Georgia.
Again, we're talking about four or five people here, okay? I mean, this is not a wave. And by the way, the same four or five people that we were talking about in all my interviews 2 years ago when we were going through the same fiscal cliff, although it was the debt ceiling bill. So it's the same cast of characters that have been brought out for the photographs again. Mm-hmm. And in point of fact, the four or five guys did not turn into a snowball. In fact, we got $2.5 trillion in spending restraint in no tax increases, something Obama's trying to relitigate now.
Of course, that was Grover Norquist this week on Morning Edition.
Well, but he is the new host, is he not?
Well, he's that too. Matter of fact, Steve Inskeep signed the pledge. As very few people know that. Grover Norquist will make the point with some validation that George H.W. Bush violated the pledge in 1992, and you saw what happened to him. But there are a lot of Republicans. Look, Saxby Chambliss seems ripe for a challenge in 2014, but he says, look, this is a pledge I made 20 years ago. It was applicable 20 years ago. It's a different situation now.
I think a lot of people are beginning to notice Grover Norquist, who never had before, and to realize the degree to which this pledge that he's been taking around and getting people to sign since the mid-'80s kind of grew out of the New Hampshire no-tax pledge, no income tax, no sales tax pledge. Very effective in presidential primaries there in New Hampshire, and then that became a national phenomenon in the hands of Grover Norquist. He's a very successful policy entrepreneur, and yet, in the end, what does it really mean? Does he really have some sort of grip on the Republican House? Does he really have a grip on 40 senators that they could not possibly vote for higher taxes because of him? Yeah. Or is there another reason?
Well, I think there is another reason because, Dick Lugar didn't lose his primary because of Grover Norquist. The challenges to so-called moderate or establishment Republican House members and senators, the threat is not coming from Grover Norquist. It's from conservative Tea Party elements back home who just feel that if you deviate from this pledge, you're soft on taxes and ripe for a challenge. And it was interesting, too, like the big Senate news. I mean, of course, here we are talking about 2014 already. But the big Senate news I thought this week was when Shelley Moore Capito, the longtime congresswoman from West Virginia, the daughter of former Governor Archmore, she announced that she's going to take on Jay Rockefeller in 2014. Almost immediately, there was a press release from Club for Growth that said she's too moderate. She voted for the bailout. She voted to save the auto industry, Fannie and Freddie, and they're back talking about a right-wing primary challenge.
When was the last time, Ken, that a Republican won a Senate seat in the state of West Virginia?
Oh, it was just the other day. It was 1956. And that candidate lost 2 years later in a special election.
To Robert C. Byrd.
That's correct.
And that's how Robert C. Byrd began the longest career in the Senate in the United States history in 1958. Was that Republican?
I think it was Chapman Revercombe, I think. I didn't plan this.
That is... absolutely correct. I did plan this. This was a total trap for you, and you knew his name.
God, I'm so happy.
Revercombe. Chapman Revercombe.
I know. I'm so happy right now.
I'm speechless with disappointment. But at any rate, we will move along. Coming up sooner, another special election for a House seat. This one is Jesse Jackson Jr.'s seat in mostly Chicago, with some suburban portion of that district. And this is a seat that the congressman has resigned following a long period of time of hospitalization. He's had a long bout with depression. His attorneys are negotiating with the Justice Department over money that he diverted from his campaign, apparently, to pay for home improvements. That's illegal. So he's stepping down. He's leaving his seat. And usually when a member of Congress from Illinois, particularly Chicago, suddenly leaves and there's a special election, there's really quite a scramble among those people who have been waiting a long time for an opportunity for a lifetime seat.
Well, it could be a lifetime. I mean, basically, Jesse Jackson perhaps could have held it for a lifetime. He's had it for 17 years. What I love about this district, this is the second congressional district in Illinois. It's South Chicago and also the suburbs, as you say. It also was a majority white district and it became majority black very, very quickly from 1980 to 1990. In 1990, they elected Gus Savage, who was a race baiter from day one, a very controversial figure, who got beaten years later by Mel Reynolds, a Rhodes Scholar, who's supposed to make a big difference, until about a year later when he was apparently having sex with an underage girl. Then he was resigned from Congress after he was indicted and convicted and sent to jail, and then came Jesse Jackson. And then Jesse Jackson Jr.'s career seemed to be unraveling when Barack Obama was elected president and he wanted the Senate seat and those deals with Rod Blagojevich.
Although he was never indicted for anything that happened at that time.
No. Nope.
Rod Blagojevich wound up going to federal prison where he is today.
True, but there was always suspicion about Jesse Jackson Jr. about what he may have spent or what he promised to spend to pay to get that Senate appointment. So his star has been falling since at least December of 2008. And so we have this new election. About five or six or seven African-American candidates have been talking about running, including Napoleon Harris, the former NFL lineman who was just elected to the state Senate.
And isn't Mel Reynolds now out of jail and interested in returning to his own seat?
Well, of course, you know, he was convicted of a felony, but just because you were convicted of a felony, you can still run for office again. Mel Reynolds is one of the names who's seriously talking about running in that seat. But the point is, if you have 8 or 9 black candidates in the race, you also have a white candidate, Debbie Halverson.
Who used to be a congresswoman.
Who ran against Jesse Jackson Jr. in this year's primary and lost 71-29.
Not
but,
good.
But against 8 or 9 black candidates.
29 might look pretty good.
As the only white candidate in the race. So the African-American community is really trying to coalesce around one candidate. Anyway, Governor Pat Quinn announced that the special Democratic primary will be February 26th. Of course, that is tantamount, as we like to say, tantamount to election in that district. We'll see who the candidates are.
Oh, and speaking of House seats, by the way, Ken, I believe that we can finally pop the champagne and pour yourself a toast because all 435 House races have now been determined.
The last one was North Carolina 7. Mike McIntyre, first elected in 1996, was declared the winner. The Republican opponent withdrew his challenge. The recount showed that David Rauser was not going to win. And now that 2012 is finished, it's on to 2013.
Oh, yes, on to 2013.
Well, you know the song Bowling for Dollars? Well, there's no bowling for governor. Bill Bowling, the Republican lieutenant governor of Virginia, announced this week that he will not run for governor, even though it might be his term. But Ken Cuccinelli, the attorney general, favorite of the conservative wing of the Republican Party, Cuccinelli, says he's definitely running. Bowling knows in a state convention, which is how they pick their nominees in Virginia, he could not beat Cuccinelli, so he announced he will not run for governor.
Okay, so you say it was his turn, or might have been considered his term, because in the rather strict hierarchy by which these things are done, the governor has to move on. There's a one-term term limit, and the lieutenant governor usually gets the nomination to succeed him in the Republican Party, and to some degree in the Democratic Party, if they have an incumbent lieutenant governor. But here's another question. Is there any chance Bowling now runs as an independent?
Well, we've seen that before. We did see when Oliver North ran.
He said he was suspending his campaign, not absolutely ending it, and he said there needed to be an independent voice.
Well, he did say when he was asked, would you run on the Cuccinelli ticket? He said, I absolutely would not run on the same ticket as Ken Cuccinelli. So there's obviously bad blood there. We did see that in the past, in the previous years, 1994, when Oliver North ran for the Senate as a Republican nominee. There was a Republican who ran as an independent because he just didn't like Oliver North. There may be a possibility of Bowling running as an independent, but either way, this is good news for the Democratic Party. I think it's obviously going to be Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic nominee. The Democrats would love to run against Cuccinelli, but, you know, the Republicans would love to run against Terry McAuliffe.
Well, then, if the lieutenant governor were to run as an independent, would that be a case of Bowling alone?
You know, Ron, your mind is always in the gutter.
You can strike that.
Oh, spare me. But there's another governor race next year, and that's Chris Christie. And new polls show him to be, I mean, we talked about how his embrace of Barack Obama might hurt him among some Republicans, some conservatives. It's made him unbelievably popular in the state.
Unbeatable,
of, yeah,
probably.
That's what it looks like right now.
Going into the election year.
So, of course, we don't think this 77% approval rating will last, but Chris Christie, as horrific as Hurricane Superstorm Sandy was to the state, it was great news for Chris Christie's political career. And as of now, he goes into a reelection bid as a prohibitive favorite.
The Democrats are expected to nominate Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, already something of a national figure. A lot of people call him, you know, Obama II. Would Cory Booker pass on this particular gubernatorial election because he didn't want to kick off his statewide career and perhaps national career with a big loss?
Depends on what the numbers look like. By the filing deadline, we still have months to go. And there's also some rumors that Cory Booker is looking at Frank Lautenberg's Senate seat in 2014 when Lautenberg will, you know, decide whether to run again. And the guessing is he doesn't. And if there's some indication that he won't do it, perhaps Booker is looking at that race.
That would make it possible for New Jersey to become the first state in history to have a Hispanic American in the Senate and an African-American in the Senate. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
You mean this is edited?
Believe me, you should hear the pre-edited edition.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Oh, traveling down the turnpike, heading for the shore. A thought just then occurred to me I never thought before. I've been a lot of places, seen pictures of the rest, but of all the places I can think of, I like Jersey best. Betting halls, shopping malls, good old Rutgers U, 47 shoe stores.